In this hour, Focus, we'll be talking about what at this point seems to be a very promising new approach to the treatment of cancer and the physician who developed the approach. And our guest for the show is Robert Cook. He's a science writer. He has spent now more than 30 years covering science and medicine for a number of major newspapers. Right at the moment, he's working for Newsday. He's also written for the Boston Globe, the Atlanta Journal, and the Atlanta Constitution. And his new book here, the one that we're talking about here this morning, is titled Dr. Folkman's War, which is about a physician named Judah Folkman who developed this idea that has to do with the way that tumors grow. And we'll explain what all this is about. His idea, though, was in getting to understand how it is that tumors grow. If you understand that process, you can intervene and you can essentially switch it off. And use a rather different approach towards treating cancer than we have in the past, where people have been subjected to big doses of chemotherapy and radiation that can be very, very debilitating to the patients. This is a rather different approach. Initially, many doctors and scientists said that it wouldn't work, and now it appears that it does. At least it's being tested, and as I say, it looks quite promising right at the moment. So the book is Dr. Folkman's War, Angiogenesis and the Struggle to Defeat Cancer. It's published by Random House, and it has been out now for a couple of months. And as we talk this morning with author Robert Cook, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So it's 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Cook, hello.
Good day. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to take the time.
Before going on and perhaps talking about Judah Folkman and who he is and something of his life and what he's done, I want to, right at the beginning here, give people the basic idea. And it does seem relatively straightforward, at least to explain. I'm sure it's more complicated than that. But the basic idea for this this process that Dr. Folkman discovered, or at least in experiments he started thinking about this, and actually a long time ago started thinking about this, seems pretty straightforward, and that is the idea that tumors can't grow unless they have a blood supply. He noticed that somehow tumors have a way of actually attracting blood vessels, so they will have a blood supply. And from there, he said, well, if we can understand how that works and we can turn it off, then you starve the tumor and it's an attractive alternative to the other therapies that now have been the predominant ones for some time.
And what we should start with is an understanding of one key word in this whole process, and the word is angiogenesis.
Right.
Angiogenesis means the growth of new blood vessels. And if you look what happens in living organisms, ourselves included, for most of our life, we don't grow any brand new blood vessels except in an emergency, which is to treat a wound or to help a wound heal, or in women at the end of the menstrual period to rebuild the uterine wall. So blood vessel growth is highly unusual, which means it must be highly controlled, and that's what Judah Folkman has been pursuing, the idea that blood vessels can grow or cannot grow under very tight controls. And he's been looking for some way to get his hands on the controlling levers.
Mm-hmm. And I gather this was something that medical science didn't really understand very well, and something that not only has applications in the area of cancer, but in other areas as well.
Well, one of the things that stood in Judah Folkman's way is the fact that he's a surgeon, and surgeons and biologists and oncologists don't do a lot of communicating between each other. Surgeon comes in and does his cutting and stitching and then goes away and leaves the doctors the medical doctors to cope with the results. But so that was an intellectual barrier between the two sides. But Folkman is, by nature, a problem solver and a taker of data and a synthesizer. He puts things together, and he noticed that in his early experiments, while he happened to be in the Navy, that a tumor couldn't grow unless it recruited a blood supply. And just like any other organ in the body, without blood, the organ can't live. A tumor is, in essence, almost an independent organ.
Mm-hmm. And what he did was, as he was thinking about this, he had this realization that no blood supply, the tumor can't grow. Then his next step was to think, well, how is it that the tumor manages to get a blood supply?
Right. Well, how does the tumor interact with its host?
Yeah.
This is like a parasite growing in you or me. And he said, well, the tumor has to have a blood supply. How does it get it? It has to signal the body somehow to send in fresh new blood vessels, and the signaling mechanisms might be electrical signals, might be immunological signals, but he said, well, it's probably a chemical signal, a growth factor that the tumor itself releases, telling the blood vessels nearby to sprout new branches. And over almost 20 years of research, it took a long time to actually find those signals, but he turned out to be absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And his idea was, if you can find that signal, if you can understand this process, then you can essentially turn it off.
Well, the idea is to make cancer into a chronic disease. If you can stop the tumors from growing by shutting off their blood supply, in essence, you starve them to death.
Mm-hmm.
But his basic idea, one was you could interfere with the signal, or perhaps the body has other controlling elements, other factors that can actually shut down blood vessel growth, even erase the blood vessels that have formed. And that's also turning out to be true.
Hmm. Is the thinking that this has potential for treating all forms of cancer or just some forms of cancer?
Well, in the experiments in mice, it reached the point where they would... people in Folkman's laboratory at Children's Hospital in Boston would go down to treat their mice in the animal room without even asking what kind of tumor it was. It didn't matter as long as it was a solid tumor they could look at. Ironically, it's turning out there is some evidence that even blood cancers, the leukemias, may be dependent on this phenomenon called angiogenesis, because there's some evidence that for leukemia to really get going, the bone marrow has to be infiltrated by tiny new blood vessels, capillaries. And it's remarkable and not yet a firm conclusion, but it certainly is interesting evidence.
What sort of experimentation has been conducted to date on human beings?
Well, we've been just now finishing up the first toxicity trials, phase one clinical trials, in which they give very, very small doses of the agents that Folkman's people have found to cancer patients who are at the end stage of disease and have failed all other treatments. And so far, I think in more than 80 patients, they have seen no significant toxicity at all. Unlike chemotherapy, they have not got sick. There's no diarrhea. There's no hair loss. No, nothing. And a few of the patients, just a handful who have gotten to the higher doses, are showing signs that their tumors have stopped growing. It's really very exciting.
Hmm. Let me just real quick introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Robert Cook. He is a science, medical and science writer, has been for quite a number of years and has written for a number of publications. Right at the moment, he works for Newsday, and he is the author of the book that we're talking about that profiles physician Dr. Judah Folkman and his research on angiogenesis. And how the understanding of the way that tumors affect the bodies of people, how that is the tumor gets its blood supply, can be used to actually get rid of the tumor by denying the tumor the blood supply and, in a sense, starving it. And as we have said, it's something where there is ongoing research, and it seems to be very promising as a technique in treating cancer. If you're interested in reading more about it, you can look for the book. Again, it's titled Dr. Folkman's War, and it's published by Random House. You tell the story of Judah Folkman and his growing up and his life. His father was a rabbi, and apparently the way that Judah Folkman got set on the path of becoming a physician was that his dad would take him, when he was a boy, would take him along to the hospital to visit people who were sick. And that must have made a strong impression on the young Judah Folkman.
Well, at age 7, I think If the child in the Folkman household had behaved properly, the father, the rabbi, would take them on these rounds to the hospital. And I think after 3 years of frequently going to the hospital, watching the rabbi deal with the patients and the patient's relatives, Judah Folkman noticed something. He said, I see the rabbi is very helpful, my father's very helpful, but the doctor actually gets in the oxygen tent and works on these people and makes them better. And I'm going to be a doctor rather than a rabbi. And it was really interesting. His father, who'd, I guess, assumed that Judah Folkman was going to also become a rabbi, said, well, okay, you can be a rabbi like doctor. And that's exactly what he is. He is very much of a rabbi-like doctor, and one of the kindest and most thoughtful individuals I've ever met.
Hmm. And it seems also that in the Folkman household that the parents placed a very high value on thinking and on learning, and that certainly contributed to the kind of person that he turned out to be.
Well, if you remember, Judah Folkman was born in 1933, which was in the depths of the Depression. So there wasn't a lot of money to go around, particularly in a rabbi's household. But every opportunity they had to help their children learn and be curious about the world was taken. They would go to museums all the time. If the kids were taken to the doctor, Mrs. Folkman would suggest maybe that the doctor let them look through the microscope and see what's going on in the doctor's office. And, of course, Judah, I think, was naturally curious. He had a chemistry set early, and he was always into experiments. And his mother read things like Tom Swift books to the kids before bedtime. So kind of a family built-in curiosity and a love of learning.
Yeah. There's a great story in the book where apparently the grandfather had thought about giving to Judah as a present, a Jeep. He was going to buy a war surplus Jeep because they were really cheap. And his brothers and sisters apparently thought, well, this is great. He can drive us around. He can take us to school. And the Judah said, well, actually, you know, I think I'd rather have a microscope, which apparently disappointed his siblings quite a bit. But that shows what he really was interested in, what was really important to him.
Well, that was right after World War II, and you know, teenagers of that age, at that time, was a set of wheels was really hot stuff. You know, made you somebody at school. I grew up in Southern California in the hot rod culture, and your car was your identity. And his brother and sister thought, boy, we could drive up to school in that Jeep. We'd really be somebody. But you know, Folkman had his eye focused on learning and on science, and said, give me the microscope instead. That's far more important to me.
Mm-hmm. He went to Harvard Med School, and when he was there, definitely showed his promise, not only as the physician that he would be, but as someone who could develop novel solutions to particular problems. In fact, one of the things you write about is that he developed the first implantable pacemaker when he was in med school there at Harvard.
The day he got to Harvard as a first-year medical student, he had signed up to work in the lab of Dr. Robert Gross, who was a pioneering surgeon dealing with babies born with heart defects. You know, remember the story of the blue babies who had blood leaking from one chamber to another in the heart, and he was working on finding ways to sew that up. What happened was he'd have to work with his hands submerged in a pool of blood because there was no heart-lung machine that would take care of circulation while this was going on, and sometimes he had to do it essentially in braille by feel, and he would sever the nerve that keeps the heart beating regularly. So one of the tasks he gave to Judah Folkman was to think about and try to develop some method to keep the heart beating regularly if that nerve got severed, and that's what Judah Folkman did. He went over across the river to MIT and was introduced to a young electrical engineer over there, and he sat down and thought out how to do this. That's just when transistors were invented, so they had small electronic components they could work with, and they built this little pacemaker that was triggered by the nerve impulse, and it would then sort of put out an impulse of its own to get the heart going at the right rate. And it worked. They could strap it to the outside of a dog and turn the switch off. The dog would have to lie down and be almost comatose. They'd turn the switch on, the dog would get up and walk around. Now, because of Harvard's policies. They never patented it, so it never became a commercial development. But that was really the first implantable pacemaker, if they had chosen to implant it in the dog.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to draw some comparisons between that time and now, when it was much more the case that people, when they developed some things like this, I think the idea was that if you invent something where there could be great public benefit, there was some problem with the idea of personally benefiting, and certainly such a thing you can't hardly imagine today somebody inventing something like that and essentially giving it away and saying, well, this is for the world. I don't really need to profit from this personally.
The problem is, if you think about it, if it's not patented and protected, the next step, which is developing an invention into a useful commercial device, doesn't happen, because who's going to pour a lot of money into developing a pacemaker if, when you get done, you have no patent on it and anybody can make it? Companies don't work that way. So the U.S. government is even promoting the patenting of devices found in under government-funded research, because if there's no patent, nothing gets developed.
Hmm. We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that on our line number one. They're in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting on angiogenesis. I'm wondering, how selective is the process that it can only stop the formation of blood vessel growth to tumors and not inhibit perhaps the growth of blood vessels throughout the rest of the body?
Well, that has been tested in mice, and it doesn't seem to hamper wound healing, and it also doesn't seem to hamper the growth of blood vessels to feed a new fetus, as in getting ready for reproduction. Perhaps the reason is that the blood vessels that a tumor draws in are drawn in an emergency fashion, and they don't seem to be mature or complete blood vessels. They don't seem to have the smooth muscles that form around them to make a complete and stable blood vessel, so they're easily erased. That seems to be what the evidence is showing. I'm not sure it's clear yet.
Okay. I remember back several years that shark cartilage was used as a method for angiogenesis. Is this the same basis that he's using, is it based on something derived from, quote-unquote, a natural source and synthesized somehow?
Well, that came out of Judah Folkman's laboratory in the mid-1970s, when he was looking around for places in the body where blood vessels seemed to be excluded. Cartilage was one. When you're developing in the womb, there's a rich array of blood vessels feeding the cartilage to make it grow. But gradually, those are excluded, and if you look at cartilage in an adult, there's hardly any blood vessel support for that, because it doesn't need a lot of growth. So he said, well, where do you look for cartilage? And sharks have a lot of it. So they started exploring that and actually found a factor that seems to work, at least to some degree, to exclude blood vessels from shark cartilage. What happened, though, is they published on that. He and Robert Langer, who's at MIT as a chemical engineer, published on it, and a gentleman who saw that decided he would grind up shark cartilage and sell it as an anti-cancer powder. The problem with that is it doesn't work when it's ingested through the digestive system. It just gets digested and goes out, apparently. This factor has to be purified and injected under the skin or in the blood to make it work. So it really hasn't been developed as a commercial product yet, except for sale in health food stores, and does not seem to work.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Robert Cook about his book, Dr. Folkman's War, Angiogenesis and the Struggle to Defeat Cancer. We're going to pause just for a second here, and we'll get back to our conversation. We want to take a moment to bring in our station manager, Dan Simeone. We've been talking with him on and off on the air now for probably a couple of weeks as we get closer and closer to the end of the fiscal year here at WILL. And that's important because the money that we spend on all of the programming, everything we do next year, needs to be in the bank by that time. We are very close to the target we've set, but we need to raise just a little bit more money. And we're hoping here over the next couple of days we can encourage some folks to make a contribution.
That's right, David. And I want to thank many people who have helped us raise more than $631,000 so far this year. That's great. We're on our way to our goal of $700,000, but we still have about $67,000 plus to go to meet that goal, and we have just a few days left, as David said. It's important to realize that this station is really fundamentally different from other radio stations you might listen to, because the program decisions that are made here are based on improving the quality of the service to you, not based on how much money we can raise from advertisers. And that's one of the reasons why you can enjoy a program like this with David each day and have a chance to interact with knowledgeable people on a variety of different subjects. We hope you appreciate that and that you'll take this opportunity to support this station as we move toward the end of our fiscal year. Your $40 basic membership contribution can make a big difference right now. You can contribute more or less. But let me give you the phone number to call. It's 217-333-0850. And you can make a credit card contribution right now by calling that number. You can also still mail in a pledge to the Friends of WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Or you can even contribute on our secure website by credit card, wyll.uiuc.edu. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. And this is Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program. And again, our guest this morning is Robert Cook. For now more than 30 years, he's written about science and medicine for a number of major newspapers, including the Boston Globe, the Atlanta Journal and Constitution, and also now Newsday. His book, Dr. Folkman's War, looks at angiogenesis and the struggle to defeat cancer. It's published by Random House. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222. WILO. Judah Folkman sort of got his first burst of inspiration on the issue of angiogenesis when he was in the Navy, working as a doctor and doing medical research. And apparently the first thing that he was there to work on was the development of an artificial blood, right?
Yes, that's correct. He was one of a number of young doctors, when drafted, was assigned to the Naval Research Laboratory in Bethesda, Maryland, to look at various solutions because the Navy wanted to see if they could devise some kind of artificial blood that could be kept in storage for a long time because of ships far at sea might need it in a hurry. And an aircraft carrier, they could tap the blood of the crew for a while, but then they would probably soon use up that supply and needed something in storage they could use. Otherwise, they have to keep coming ashore to get fresh blood. It lasts 21 days in storage. So the goal was to test all these solutions, including dried hemoglobin that had been reconstituted with saline water, and see if they could get something that would keep people alive long enough to survive injuries.
Hmm. And so what was it, after having been involved in that work, that led him to start thinking about tumors and how it is that they grew? Was there sort of a natural connection there between those things?
Well, it was a kind of a serendipitous connection. Judah Folkman and his friend Fred Becker did so well with their tests on blood, on artificial blood, that they had it all done in a couple months' time and still had probably more than half of their stint yet to do in the Navy. So they went to their captain and said, well, we've finished our work. Can we go home and go back to medical school or to our residencies? And the Navy says, no soap. You're here for 2 years. You're here for 2 years. You've got to fill it out. And they had nothing to do. They still had their testing apparatus in the laboratory. So the captain in charge said, well, just go ahead and do what you want. Just don't tell anybody. And so one of the questions they wanted to explore was, could they make cells actually grow with the solutions they were looking at, and there are no cells that grow better than cancer cells, so they got a sample of cancer cells and plugged them into a little an animal thyroid gland, as they had been doing earlier with the in their experiments, and kept pumping fluids through that. The funny thing was, these little tumor samples grew, but stopped suddenly, all at the same size, probably less than 2 millimeters in diameter, and that raised the question, why? Why do they all stop at the same size? That doesn't happen in normal situations.
Mm-hmm. And then again, that gets us back to this idea. And if people have maybe just joined us, it gets us back to this idea that he said, what's happening is here is they don't get any bigger because they don't have a blood supply, which is what happens in the body, which then led him to this asking this question, how is it that happens? And if we can understand that, then can we get in there and intervene in that mechanism and prevent tumors from growing?
Yeah, what they did was they said, if these little tumors don't grow in the thyroid gland, what's wrong with them? Did we kill them? And so they took them back out and they put them into live mice, and those little samples of tumor cells blossomed into major tumors that would kill the animals. So they knew they were still alive, but something had blocked them from growing, and that's what led to this major idea about the need for a blood vessel system. Yeah. The problem was, at the time, most people thought just about everything was known about the blood vessels anyway. They were considered just pipes that carried blood around to various parts of the body, and what do you need to know about a series of pipes? And so everybody kind of poo-pooed the idea that they were important to cancer.
Yeah. He, after getting out of the Navy, he went back into being a doctor. He continued being a doctor and was apparently a great surgeon, and so good, in fact, he was appointed to the job of chief of surgery at Boston Children's Hospital, even though he really didn't have any training in doing surgery on children. And in fact, what they did was to get him so that he could take on that job, they sent him for an intensive training period with C. Everett Koop for 6 months to learn pediatric surgery.
Well, what they did was, you see, Harvard, being at the top of the scale, rarely sent anybody elsewhere for training, because the best training they get was at Harvard. But they did send him to Everett Koop in Philadelphia, and Koop squeezed 2 years' worth of surgical training into 6 months. And he had arranged for patients to be sent in from all over the area that he and Folkman could collaborate on. Koop on one side of the patient, Folkman on the other, learning how to do this very, very delicate surgery on tiny children. It is a specialty, and it's very difficult and takes great skill. And, of course, Koop already had the skill, and Folkman soon developed it.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Koop, he has apparently rather high regard for Dr. Folkman.
They have remained good friends through all these years, ever since 1969, and so much so that Dr. Koop was willing to write the foreword to the book.
Yeah. And I guess it was this the fact that Judah Folkman had such great skill and capacity as a surgeon that led many people to be disappointed in his decision to pursue this cancer research, because at the time a lot of people said, this couldn't work, this isn't the right approach, it doesn't make any sense. There must have been a lot of people who thought that what Judah Folkman was doing was throwing away a great career as a surgeon to pursue this research that at the time looked like it would lead no place.
Well, there were two sets of problems there. One, since he was chief of surgery, he was on call all the time to do the very difficult cases or the very important cases on short notice. And he told me once the Harvard president's daughter had an auto accident and her face was cut up rather badly, and he was called away at a most inopportune time to come in and do that surgery and get it right. You know, you don't do that one wrong. At the same time, the people who are really involved in cancer research are wondering, what's this surgeon doing meddling in our field? He can't be real. And so he had two sets of barriers there. One, the surgeons wanted him there, as they say, in his underwear, in a surgical gown, doing surgery full time. Well, he wanted to put in half time and spend the rest of the time on his research. So dissatisfaction was coming up all around him.
Mm-hmm. And he, early on, we should point out, I think when he first had this idea about angiogenesis when he was in the Navy, this was in 1961, I think.
In that area.
And it was then sometime later when he started trying to get funding and published his first paper on this was maybe about 10 years later.
Right.
He did early on have a real tough time getting funding to do the work. Again, I guess because it was the prevailing view within the scientific community that this wasn't going to go anywhere. So the National Institutes of Health apparently gave him a little bit of money, but weren't really enthusiastic about the research.
He got some American Cancer Society money, as what they call a career development grant, I think, that helped him get set up at first, and then he would have to try to get funds from the National Institutes of Health, National Cancer Institute, things like that. But there was one woman in Texas whose son had been treated by Dr. Folkman as a surgeon, who was so taken with Dr. Folkman and his idea that she set up a little foundation of her own, and when friends would come over, she would try to get them to make donations. I think it's a Mrs. Franz, whose husband had been ambassador to Austria. And so she would put together little bits of money anyway and send to support his research in anti-angiogenesis. And one of Folkman's best students, Bruce Zetter, was supported by that money and made a key discovery that led to the treatments that are being used today.
Hmm.
So you can't overemphasize the value of individuals trying to help on their own.
We have a caller here, somebody on a cell phone, so let's bring them into the program here on our line number 4. Hello?
Yes, I was wondering about this process of stopping blood vessels or creating them in the area of people that have heart attacks and their blood vessels have been occluded. Is research going in that direction, or the opposite way of stimulating blood vessels? Thank you.
Well, what is happening right now is in several medical centers around the country, there are some physicians who are experimenting with the blood-inducing or the blood vessel-inducing agents that have been found in various laboratories. One of them is called VEGF, which is stands for vascular endothelial growth factor, and another one is BFGF, which is basic fibroblast growth factor, both of which are potent in stimulating new blood vessel growth. And these are the things that Folkman looked for so long. And somebody else found VEGF, and his team in his own laboratory found fibroblast growth factor. What is happening is that they're using these factors now to induce new blood vessel growth in people's hearts and in people's legs, and it's already they're saving lives with the heart treatments, and they're saving people's legs from being amputated with the leg treatments. It is working, and in a sense, it's even genetic engineering that is working.
All right. I hope that gets the question of the caller. Others are welcome to call in and join the conversation. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We talked a little bit about the search for the active agent here in the first part of the show. And again, that it's one thing to posit that the tumors are releasing some kind of chemical signal that is attracting blood vessels to come and feed them. It's another thing to try to figure out what that thing is. And as you explained, the major approach at the beginning was to think, well, what parts of the body don't have blood vessels? And can we look at those and try to figure out, is there some reason that that part of the body doesn't? And was that the place that they started?
Yes, they started looking for a system in which they could measure blood vessel growth as induced by the stimulating factors. And one place was the cornea in the eye, which is exquisitely free of blood vessels, and rightly so. If the cornea of the eye was full of blood vessels, of course we would be blind. That would block light. So you have to have a perfectly clear tissue. How does it keep blood vessels out? And so they looked at various tissues looking for places or kinds of factors that keep blood vessels out. What they ended up doing, they never really found too much there except as a system for measuring blood vessel growth. But the shark cartilage was the first tissue to yield that kind of an anti-angiogenesis factor. But then another person in Folkman's laboratory, Michael O'Reilly, was put to the task on a completely different tack and found two very potent agents that that cause blood vessels to disappear. One is called angiostatin, and the other is endostatin. Both of these factors are now in clinical trials against tumors, and they seem to work. But that was found by a different method.
Mm-hmm. Well, here, I guess there's another question, and I hope I can state this without getting too tangled up here. But one of the questions that he was interested in is, why is it that in some cases, if you have a tumor and you surgically remove it, that then you will see growth of other tumors? And he started asking, well, is something happening, is the first tumor not only doing something to attract a blood supply to it, but suppressing the growth, essentially, of other tumors? And that when the main tumor is removed, then something then is also removed from the body, and suddenly now you see the growth of other tumors.
Yeah, that was a mystery that had faced surgeons and cancer doctors for probably a century. If a patient goes home after having a major tumor removed and comes back 2, 3, 4 weeks later with all the metastases erupting elsewhere in the body, why is that? And they wondered, well, what kept those tumors at bay while the primary tumor was there? And as it turned out, the primary tumor was releasing some kind of factor, and they've been identified as angiostatin, endostatin, and several others, that keeps smaller tumors from growing. And once that is gone, these smaller tumors are also putting out their factors that induce blood vessel growth, and boom, it takes off, and it kills the patient. You know, it's metastases, which is usually the cause of death in cancer patients. So if you can control those, you might be in pretty good shape. So that was the clue that led to the discovery of these factors, and they found them by doing experiment after experiment in mice. And they now have factors that can drive the tumors right down in mice with no side effects.
So all of this, we're talking about something that was the result of a lot of painstaking research that took a long time, because we're really looking here at between the time, say, in the early 60s that he started thinking about this idea, and that we really get some significant payoffs here. We're looking at maybe 30 years?
40 years, actually.
40 years.
We're just now reaching the clinical trials. We're showing some interesting benefits, but when you start out in a new science, you have to start from scratch. And Judah Folkman had to, one, come up with the ideas, two, develop the test to see what he was trying to find, and three, actually find these factors that nobody believed in. And as one scientist once said, that if you call it a factor, it's clear you don't know what you're talking about. So you've got to find the chemical, identify it, and find out where it works and where it doesn't work. It's very, very difficult.
Hmm. And now at this point, is it generally accepted that, in fact, he was his idea about how tumors grow, the fact that there was this factor that if you could identify it, you could use that as a tool of treatment? Is it now generally accepted that, well, he was right, and that this does have great promise?
Well, the four major premises he came up with, one, that tumors are dependent on blood vessel growth, is absolutely right, no doubt. Second, that they call in a blood supply of their own. That is also true, no doubt. Three, that they produce a factor that the tumor releases and calls in blood vessels. That is true, no doubt. And now what is turning out to be true also is that factors exist which can drive blood vessel growth down or make it stop. And that is turning out to be true. They found them. They know their chemical structure. So each of those four premises is now really quite firm.
We have 7 or 8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and again, I should introduce our guest. We're talking with science writer Robert Cook. His book is Dr. Folkman's War, Angiogenesis and the Struggle to Defeat Cancer, and it is about this physician, Dr. Judah Folkman, and his idea about this, what is turning out to be, what seems to be a rather promising method of treating cancer. And the book is out now. It's published by Random House. So if you're interested in that subject, you're interested in medical research and how things progress, you might want to take a look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome here. We have time for a couple if there are people who have questions here in Champaign-Urbana. The number to call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. A little bit earlier, we had a question from someone who was interested in the idea of whether this kind of research, sort of another direction of research, as the mirror, sort of the flip side to the idea of denying tumors their blood vessels and starving them, using this to promote the growth of blood vessels. And one area in which they're looking at that is heart disease. Another apparently is macular degeneration.
Yeah, one of the problems in the eye is, and if you particularly see it in diabetic people who have what they call diabetic retinopathy, in which the abnormal growth of tiny capillaries in the retina of the eye gradually destroys the retina and makes these people blind. The same thing happens in macular degeneration, where in an age-related condition you get abnormal blood vessel growth in certain parts of the retina. What they're learning is that the abnormal growth is triggered by this little growth factor called VEGF. And if they can block the function of VEGF, maybe they can save a lot of people's eyesight. That research is going very, very fast and very, very well. And in animal experiments, at least, they're showing that they can block the destruction of the retina in under these conditions. So it's enormously promising. But what Dr. Folkman has said over the years is that there are about 26 different diseases that are caused either by too much or too little blood vessel growth. And if you can control that, there could be enormous impact on a variety of diseases. One of them is psoriasis, and there are some hints that it's already going to work against psoriasis, this troublesome skin disorder.
We have another call here. Let's talk with this person. They're in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. I'm not sure if I missed something. Maybe this has already been said, but what is the name of this treatment for cancer, and like, what is the substance or chemical or drug that's used, and where is this available? Can people actually go to be treated with it?
The drugs are named, the first one discovered was called angiostatin, which is now in clinical trials in Philadelphia, Thomas Jefferson University.
Angiostatin. Mm-hmm.
Second one, which got into trials earlier and is being most used now in people, is called endostatin.
Mm-hmm.
That was found in Folkman's laboratory in 1996. Has been used in more than 80 people and is showing signs of efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
The remarkable thing is no side effects.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike chemo. The third one is called Panzem, P-A-N-Z-E-M, which is a little fragment of the estrogen molecule, which is a very potent inhibitor of blood vessel growth. It's being tried out in Indianapolis, I think Indiana University School of Medicine, and at the Mayo Clinic up in Minnesota against multiple myeloma. The Indianapolis trial is against breast cancer. That's about to go into phase two, too. Now, none of these are available commercially yet. They are still in clinical trials, mm-hmm. but they are all showing really exciting promise.
Okay. So there's no center except for those that are doing trials?
No, they're all in clinical trials, but for information, you can contact the National Cancer Institute to mm-hmm. learn about them, or the Dana-Farber Cancer Center in Boston, or the University of Wisconsin has a trial going on, and the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas also has a large trial going on with endostatin.
What was the name of the institute in Boston?
Boston is the Dana-Farber Cancer Center.
Dana-Farber.
The Dana-Farber, F-A-R-B-E-R, yeah. Named after a doctor named Sidney Farber.
Okay, all right.
And it's affiliated with Children's Hospital, right across the street, as a matter of fact.
And the one in Texas again, what was that?
M.D. Anderson. It's one of the largest cancer centers in the world.
And that's in
Houston. Yes. And the person to contact there, I guess, is Roy Herbst, H-E-R-B-S-T.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. So
you're welcome.
We're talking about here the treatments that are still experimental.
Very much so.
How long would one expect, assuming that things continue to pan out, before treatments like this would be available to anyone? You just by going into wherever it is that they get their health care.
I think that's unpredictable at present. Normally, a cancer treatment, if it survives the trials, it makes 10, 12 years to finally reach general use. On the other hand, these techniques or these new compounds are so toxin-free, don't cause any side effects, it may go far faster than that if it looks like it's really working without doing any harm. So I would bet that if it pans out as it looks like it's going to now, it's going to be quite fast, maybe just a couple of years.
Hmm. And what about, how did the cost, or perhaps at this point it's not really, it would be difficult to answer a question like this, but how would the cost of treatment compare with the methods that we're using now?
Well, I think it will be somewhat controlled by the market, but these products are fairly easy to make in with what they call biotechnological techniques using genetic engineering. That's being made by yeast cells right now. So it has the potential to be quite inexpensive, but of course when you have people selling things and you have a huge demand, the price might be high. I would be afraid that once these things reach the market, there might be a huge black market for them, because if they work, the demand is going to be enormous.
Hmm. I know that Dr. Folkman cooperated with you and you're writing this book. What does he get out of this?
Well, he gets no cash of any kind. He wants his story told in an honest and direct way, and I hope that's what I've done. He is not a person who's grasping for money. He drives a 15-year-old Buick, and I've seen him give away honoraria that he received from various organizations. One night he gave away a $50,000 honorarium from the Dana Foundation here in New York City. And he's not after money. He's after curing people. Well, he put it a nice way. What he's doing is trying to put himself out of business. If you get an adequate treatment for cancer, maybe he wouldn't be in business anymore.
Hmm. Well, we've used our time, and I want to say to you, Mr. Cook, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Very pleased to do it.
Our guest, Robert Cook, he writes for Newsday, and if you'd like to read the book that we've been talking about, once again, the title is Dr. Folkman's War, Angiogenesis and the Struggle to Defeat Cancer. It is published by Random House.